My name is Justin Gage, and you're tuned in to the Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions Podcast with your host, Jason Woodbury.
Welcome back to Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. We're so glad to be here with you. I'm very pleased to present this week's conversation, an interview I taped with pianist, composer, band leader, and writer Vijay Iyer. He's been at it since 1995, recording for labels like Savoy, Pi, and ECM, and he's collaborated with a diverse and inspiring roster along the way, including people like Amiri Baraka, Matana Roberts, Dos Racis, previous Transmissions guest Wadada Leo Smith, and many more. Last year, in collaboration with vocalist Aruj Aftab and bassist Shahzad Ismaili, he released Love in Exile on the Verb label. Writing about the album for our 2023 Aquarium Drunkard Year in Review, I said it was a spectral meeting of the minds, a haunting and luminous set that locates a nexus between ambient, jazz, and classical, all while feeling entirely conjured in the moment, because it was. Now he's back with a new ECM release, Compassion, and in another trio, reuniting with his bandmates from 2021's Uneasy, bassist Linda May Han Oh, and drummer Taishan Sori. Produced by Manfred Eicher, it is a stunning listen start to finish, from its meditative and expansive title track to the dug-down grooves of Ghostrumental, which is a startling showcase for May Han Oh's thoughtful melodic playing. There are some incredibly chosen covers too, including Roscoe Mitchell's Nuna and Stevie Wonder's Overjoyed. Everything about Compassion demonstrates the intentional focus of Iyer and his collaborators, and it was a pleasure to speak with him about it, along with lots of discussion about the feeling of post-pandemic nebulousness in the air, and his mentors Greg Tate and Baraka, and a whole lot more. I think you're really going to enjoy this one, so without further ado, why don't we let the tape roll? Settle in, here's my talk with Vijay Iyer. You are tuned into Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions, and we're glad to have you here with us. Vijay, thanks so much for being with us here on Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. We're really glad to have you. What are you, what's your day look like? What are you up to today?
Oh, juggling a little bit of piano, a little bit of, let's see, logistics around teaching and things and planning for the spring and for next year.
Wow. Yeah. So as we record this, it's quite early in the year, but you're already working on next year.
I suppose so, yeah. I was thinking next academic year, but I am also thinking about next spring of 25 and things too.
Wow, right. Well, I have been spending time listening to the new record, Compassion, and it's great. It's been such a blast to just like luxuriate in this record. I've been a fan of a lot of yours, but this one really, really struck me particularly.
That's great. I'm really happy to hear it.
This is your second outing with Linda May Han Oh and Taishan Sori, right? This is the, you guys recorded a few years ago with Uneasy?
Yes, that was the album that came out in 2021. And that was right around the time that we were starting to reopen, you know, after the shutdown year. And So then we did a lot of touring in the year, sort of like from fall 22 into spring 23. And so yeah. And then we wanted to share the fruits of that, you know, it's sort of a different animal in a way. The band became, well, the band is always sort of rejuvenated through live performance. Any band is, I think. But we sort of learned some new things about what we could do and what we could share with the world.
That's something I found, I was curious. I mean, one, with Uneasy, I know it had been recorded even earlier. It had been recorded in like 2019, if I'm right.
Right, just at the end of 2019. It was,
yeah.
Yes, the before times, as we call it. The end of the before times. Do people still call it that? I don't know.
You know, I don't know if people still call it the before times. I know for sure that that's a term that I used a lot in those days. And I think what's really funny about it is that it maybe feels even more accurate now. You know what I mean? Like, it is very clear, at least to me, in the way that I conceive of things and the way that I look at the world, that that was a different, you know, paradigm, or that there were different, we just simply looked at that time through a different lens. The pandemic, I think that, and then obviously the protests of 2020 and, you know, the subsequent presidential election, all of that stuff just sort of tore the veil off of the old way of looking at things, and it's required a new one. But I don't know if people are very comfortable with that or whether or not they know how to classify whatever is going on now. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. It's been so much about our lives has changed in the last 4 years. I mean, it's certainly disorienting as an artist to try to navigate the business because it is so transformed by online life, you know. It's not that we didn't have extremely online living prior to that, but I think the way everything got concentrated, it sort of affected everything, how we share information, how we experience culture, how we gather even, you know.
Yeah.
And what matters to us. And also it's hard often to discern what's you and what's the algorithm, you know, in terms of things like taste or, I don't know, politics or, you know, affiliations.
Yeah. I find myself thinking about that a lot as we, you know, 2024, obviously, we'll have another presidential election, and those have a way of intensifying the pitch of everything, you know. That said, it hasn't, that like the pitch never dropped, you know, or it hasn't seemed like it's dropped for these last couple of years. That intensity is definitely still in the air. And I think that what you're saying about, I mean, I feel like right now with like there being like 15 different Twitter clones, right, that we're all trying to like use. And I don't know how that feels to you. I'm still using the old Twitter more than anything, unfortunately, X or whatever it's called, and it's terrible, and it's gotten much, much worse, you know, over these last couple of years. At the same time, none of these new versions feel good either, and I think it's because maybe we don't want another one of these, you know what I mean, on some instinctual level. I think maybe people are starting to get, ask questions about like how much online life is healthy,
exactly.
and how you know, how useful even is it? Because that's the thing for me, is that it doesn't feel, there's not, the utility of it even seems diminished. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm looking at you sitting in front of a wall of LPs, so I know that you, like I, am holding it down for the 20th century.
Yeah.
Or some aspect of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, just the kind of, you know, material culture, not material in terms of materialism, but our relationship to things, you know, and other people, and that sort of being mediated through contact, you know. And that's sort of, to me, what music was always about, you know. Music was always about encounter, gathering, sharing in real space, in real time,
yeah.
You know, feeling the same thing together, or feeling some version, having an experience together. So that is, you know, I just kind of keep fighting for that as an artist and as, I don't know, I suppose as a teacher even, and as someone who at least cares about what's happening in the world.
Yeah.
The real world stakes,
would you, in the
I would say. Yeah, sorry.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah, yeah. The real world, which, by the way, is a distinction worth making. You know what I mean? I think, you know, we could go down this line of thinking, and in some ways, it's like what everybody's talking about. So maybe people are like, shut up and talk about the great new record or whatever. You know, whatever online life is, you know, even if it's a simulacrum or, or who knows what, right? Like, it is something, and we are trying to do something in cyberspace or whatever. And I think we are trying to still form communities and make connections, all of which the internet has facilitated at different times, you know? But the more it's concentrated, say, in the power, in the hands of, you know, who's in charge of it, you start to see that stuff, you know, diminishing, the capacity for community diminishing. I don't feel like X, you know, yeah, like I said, we could go down this road, but I am more curious about the fact, in the liner notes to the new record, you talk about how you experience a sense of unease, is the term that you used, making art in times of suffering, and how that unease, I think, as you say, never goes away, nor should it. That tension shapes the creative process at every stage. I'm curious a little bit about that unease. You know, when you use that term, what do you mean by it? Is it about, you know, wanting to address the times? Is it about the, you know, a hesitancy to wonder whether or not that's what you're called to do as an artist? Where does that unease sort of situate itself for you as a creative person?
Well, certainly my use of that term there was a callback to the previous album, of course.
Well, right.
But it is also that, even me titling the album, that previous album, after that feeling, but also after a piece that is on the album called Uneasy, that was itself part of something I made in 2011 with a dance company. And that was when we were already here in New York City noticing that the energy on the street and the energy among people when we gather was tense. It was, I mean, these were particularly like 10 years after 9/11 and everything that followed that, which was not, you know, not just the aftermath of that catastrophe, but everything that was done in response to it and was done to communities here in New York in response to it, or at least under cover of a quote unquote response to these attacks. And,
yeah.
And that was
right.
And then if you kind of like, so that was the birth of the so-called global war on terror and these post 9/11 wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the surveilling, mass surveilling of communities of color across the US, these roundups of people who were suspected of having allegiances to other, to you know, so-called enemy states.
Right.
You know, all of this that was, so what it was to be in New York in those years, like the first decade of the post 9/11, or basically of this century, there was both the kind of like healing process and also a melancholy and a lot of an atmosphere of tension. I remember the first experience I had at protests, you know, anti-war protests 20 years ago, not the first ever, but my first experience is here in New York, experiencing the hyper-policing that was sort of just revealing itself.
Right.
So then we started to realize what we were up against, just as human beings caught up in all of this, you know. And so that, to me, was the tension that, you know, so what is it to try to create something that is expressing joy and celebrating, being together and like, you know, especially something that's sort of an outdoor piece with a dance company in the summertime at Central Park, you know, it's not a space for melancholy exactly, but we didn't want to let go of it either. So it was about that, maybe that tension. I was reading something the other day.
Yeah.
It's actually an old essay by Edward Said. It's pretty famous. It's called On Late Style. And he talks about two authors, the second of whom is the Greek poet Kavafi, whom I did a project about with the poet Robin Cost Lewis, a couple of other folks. And so I just stumbled across it the other day, and the way he described late style, it had to do with, and he's talking about Kavafi, this poet who actually didn't, it's sort of what he's saying is that this person had late style their entire life somehow, like they, meaning like he always seemed to be suffused with the melancholy that we associate with elders who've witnessed too much, you know, and then yet the sort of sensuality and passion that is part of that. So it's that contradiction, that tension between having witnessed too much, but also feeling and seeking pleasure and joy and love, you know?
Right. Yeah. I think about how, you know, there's so often your work has a social dimension to it, right? A reflection of, you know, be it on this album, you know, sort of references to Desmond Tutu, Emmett Till, in the past, of course, specific evocations of 9/11 and, you know, sort of a evocation of those lost in the pandemic. You know, we're talking about the pandemic in 2024, and in some ways, you know, maybe we've convinced ourselves that it feels like it's past us, you know, but of course it's not, you know, we're still sort of living with it in various ways. And on top of all that, I don't feel like we talk about 9/11 still, and there's still this sort of like never forget thing. The order of magnitude of people who died in 2020 and 2021 and 2022.
Yeah.
it's staggeringly more, right?
Of course.
But it seems like culturally we have a harder time getting our hands around that situation. You know what I mean? Taking it into account at all. So
yeah, well, that's part of what I was talking about with how much has changed in the last four years, which is our the way we have adapted to mass suffering and atrocity. You know, it's very odd to be part of it, you know, to be caught up in it and to have it happen to us collectively and to then, yeah. So now I'm going to make a jazz trio record. Like, you know, what is the role of it?
Yeah.
What does it do today? You know, what is it doing today?
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, you also share in the liner notes a conversation that you had with Wadada Leo Smith, who we were fortunate enough to have on this podcast.
That's
as
wonderful.
Well.
I just saw him the other night, actually.
Well, I saw that you posted on Instagram with him, and it was one of those like nice moments of synchronicity in which I was writing out notes for this episode and had written his name down and then saw that. I was like, oh, wow, meant to be. But, you know, you talked in the liner notes about how, I mean, essentially, I don't want to like, you know, try to encapsulate your quote and boil it down into such a simple enough thing. But essentially, the crux of the question or the discussion was, you know, about how instrumental music is about something, right? You know, what gives art, in his words, its authenticity, identity, and its meaning, you know? And so what you're talking about there, I mean, I think it's a great question to ask ourselves. What does a jazz trio record mean right now? What do we need it for? What do we use it for? How does it, what kind of meaning can we bring to it? And I mean, I'm a full-on sucker and a little bit of a romantic when it comes to music. So I believe, of course, that music doesn't have to mean anything in order to truly connect sometimes. But I suppose if it does accomplish that goal, then it means something incredible, even if it's maybe mysterious or amorphous. But I'm curious for you and your collaborators, you know, Linda and Tyshawn, what kind of discussions do the three of you have going into a project about what spirit is sort of motivating it for you on an individual level? Is that something you actually sit down and discuss, lay out, map out in some way? Or is it something that more reveals itself through the project as that goes along? How does that work?
I think what I can say is that, especially with this album, because it was material that we developed over a year, I'd say that year, in terms of, you know, what is it that we can do now? And that was a year that was still characterized by, it was troublesome. You know, I remember like the first time we toured Europe in fall of 22, and we had to keep getting PCR tests everywhere we went, and then like produce a record of it in order to enter the airport. And there were these checkpoints everywhere, and we were all, you know, terrified of getting sick on the road. And then of course it's, you know, three people with non-Western roots traveling in Europe. And how do we then experience the world? What keeps happening to us? You know, I'll never forget the time. Linda at the time was still nursing her child, who's now three. And so she was traveling with a breast pump and collecting the milk and freezing it and, you know, delivering it back to her husband, and their son were staying in Amsterdam for that tour. So, and I just remember that they told her that she couldn't come in with it, even though she had followed all the guidelines that were on the website, at the airport, I mean, and, in Frankfurt. And I remember that these cops came and, looked through her stuff and confronted us. And it was very, it was just like one of these moments where it's like, why her?
Right.
Why her? Why now? Why here? You know? And you start, you know, there's things like that have happened to Tyshawn and me, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of times. And it affects the way everyone receives us and interacts with us. And so because of that, I mean, this is just to say that there's a certain perspective on the world that's born of those experiences, you know? And, you know, what I was just mentioning, in the scheme of things, it wasn't terrible, but it felt terrible at that moment. And it was just this moment of like feeling singled out in a way that it was because we had this hyper visibility as we moved around the airport, you know. So that's the kind of thing that we, in the course of being on tour, have to process. You know, we're talking a lot about everything that we're experiencing, and it's through that that certain, you know, well, you know, I think we find ourselves how should I put it, just in this deep space of understanding, mutual understanding, that then is also the space from which all this music is made, played. And also for me, you know, I think it just becomes, there's this continuity between that and my composing process, such as it is, so that it's not like, you know, there's any question about why a piece should be dedicated to Archbishop Desmond Tutu after he passes away.
Right.
It's like, what? There's nothing,
no,
There's no, it's not discrepant with how we live and how we move together in the world, you know?
Putting your music up online is not always the easiest thing in the world to figure out, but DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and as an artist, you keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. A million plus artists rely on DistroKid to get their music into Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, all the major streaming services. You can use it to edit your lyrics and your song credits. So important in the internet age to let people know the kind of people you're collaborating with. And DistroKid makes that easy. You can also see all your stats from the streamers and, of course, add a credit card to purchase album extras. The DistroKid app is available now on iOS and Android. Go to the app or Play Store to download it. Yeah, most certainly. I mean, I feel like with jazz and with the protest roots of jazz, right? And how the elements of protest when you're working with, like, you've obviously worked with lyricists in the past. You've worked with poets and, you know, Mike Ladd and other folks, you know, so it's not like there's never been lyrical components to what you're doing. But when that's not there for the listener, right, a lyric that semi spells it out in some way, it's more about this internal alchemizing that you're doing of all those feelings and then that somehow making it into the work. I mean, to me, that feels like a really powerful way that it informs the work. But it still leaves the listener with the space. And if they want to, right, if you want to engage with this music on the deepest possible level, you have the space to wander into it and suss out and parse out those meanings for yourself, right?
Yeah. And I, you know, I learned long ago, through trial and error and just through experience, you know, this is my 26th album or something, that you also have to set it free of your own sense of what it means, you know, with music, especially with instrumental music, that it can find its way to matter to somebody else in radically different ways. And that's actually part of the joy of it and the recovery process, you know. I remember I did an interview with Muhal Richard Abrams a little over, it was like 2011 or 2012 that we did this. And I actually published this interview. It was more like a conversation because I had by then known him for quite a while, like since the mid-90s. And I remember one thing he said, you know, you Did you ever notice how after you play a concert, people come up to you afterwards and everyone says something different?
Yeah.
They said, the purpose of music is to excite all these different experiences.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then, you know, there is what it means to me. There is a circumstance under which I made it. And even that is often very mysterious to me. It's like a, it's just an intuitive process of piecing things together and then sitting with it and deciding whether it needs a title. And if so, what that title might do. And even then, it's right. Sort of like that, this might just be a word, you know, a single word that, but it's sort of the word plus the circumstance in which it was born, plus what it sounds and feels like, and then plus what we do with it. So then it's already larger than intention. And especially with creative music like this, where the music is even whatever I build into it as sort of skeletal material or seed material, it's expanded on collectively, you know. So I am not the sole quote unquote author of what you're hearing in that sense, right? You're hearing creative inspirations of everyone. So so I also that's another reason that I have to kind of let these meanings just coexist, you know, and my whatever it is that I intended is never the whole story. And that's kind of the beauty of making art is.
Yeah. I mean, that it can reveal itself anew, even to you, you know, or that a song, I'm sure you've had it happen where a song takes on new meaning after some performance or, you know, event or who knows what. And it's like that meaning wasn't there before, or I didn't know that was in there. But
yeah, actually, one of the most vivid examples of that that I can remember is I had written a piece called Remembrance that I wrote for my grandparents. And my colleague, Rudresh Mahantapa, the phenomenal saxophonist, he and I used to play it together. A lot, you know, it was basically written for us to play together. And it's on our album, the album we made called Raw Materials. But I wrote it in maybe 2000. And then I remember that we were invited to perform at a memorial event shortly after 9/11. And we played that piece, and it was, it was given this whole other meaning. And then I realized how portable, I mean, in the sense of like versatile that piece could be in the sense of how it could function in the world, you know, how it could matter to other people in new ways. And then that would matter to me in a new way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A couple months ago, I saw you and Shahzad Ismaili and Aruj Aftab, and I, you know, we're talking about what music, what it's like when we experience things together, in a room full of people and with a band, you know. And this was at I'm in Arizona, so this was at Tempe Center for the Arts.
That was a good time.
I mean, well, first off, we've also had Shahzad on this podcast, and he's one of the most endlessly entertaining, fascinating, and idiosyncratic individuals that I've ever encountered,
right? I love it.
He really showcased that side of himself at that performance with his sort of impromptu address at the end, which was just great.
Yeah.
Kind of went places I didn't know it was going to go, but part of what, you know, struck me about that show was that with that record specifically, I mean, Love in Exile was absolutely one of my favorite albums of last year. I spent so much time getting lost in it, and I had, you know, had downloaded it to my phone before a very long flight that I had home from. I can't remember if it was to Dublin and Paris where I went with my wife, or and then home, or I can't remember which way, you know, there or back, but one of them. And I had long stretches where I had no, you know, nothing to do, and I was able to really just listen. And I had like a transcendent experience with that record. It's just so beautiful. Thank you. So mysterious and so, you know, voluminous is the word I want to use. There's so much space in there to wander around. I'd probably listened a handful of times before I even realized, oh yeah, you know, she is singing, right? In a dialect, you know, is it Urdu? Is that right?
Yeah, it's a language. It's actually two different languages on there, mostly Urdu, but there's one song in Punjabi.
Right. And so it kind of occurred to me, I was like, oh, well, I don't know what she's saying. I could try to figure this out, you know? And I decided just sort of that I wasn't going to, not because I'm not interested, but because to some level it was like, I don't know. I was okay with allowing for that mystery. And that's not in any way to sort of say like, you know, one should be incurious and shouldn't, like, you know, dig in deeper or whatever. But you know what I mean? Like the experience of just simply letting it be and not demanding, for me personally, a literal understanding of what it was, you know? And then when I saw the show live, I found myself thinking even more about how, because you guys didn't, you improvised those original compositions, right? The stuff we hear on the record was improvised more or less in the moment.
The term we use is live composition. And that's okay. How we always have worked from the first time we ever played, which was in 2018. We came together and started creating, and these works of art kind of came through us into the world, and it felt miraculous to us, and it still does every time, including and that's what we did in the studio, and that's what we do in every concert. And there's no you know, we clearly have ways of relating, and you know, Aruj finds ways to, what should I say, deploy these different scraps of poetry, Urdu or another poetry, and place them as music and build with them, you know. And so it's this very gentle, loving process of co-construction that happens. The reason I hesitate to use the word improvisation is that word doesn't really do justice to what's happening. And it never really did, honestly, for anybody, because it has this way of devaluing the the significance of what somebody is doing.
Devaluing because people hear that word and they think, oh, that just means they're making it up as they go along or something. You know what I mean? Is that what you
mean? It's partly that, yeah. That is part of a larger, I'd say, a structural problem, which is that it's sort of presented as the antithesis of composition.
Exactly. When it's not, right. Like the lines obviously between improv and composition are as blurry as could possibly be.
Well, I would say
always.
The line is a political line. It's not a real, in the same way that the line between the U.S. and Canada is a political line, you know, it doesn't. And then it does govern how people relate and how people act among themselves. But it's artificial, because the land is continuous, you know. And in fact, nations are made up. So all the categories are fake. but you know, all of them. So we kind of have to understand it that way, like make sure that we always apply pressure to these concepts so that we don't take them as given.
Yeah, that's beautifully stated. And also I would note that what you're saying, you know, just on a level of emotional intensity and what it felt like to be in a room and to hear that music together, to hear the three of you spontaneously composing that way. To me, it took on a sacred quality. There's a sacred quality to that sound. And it's not just because of the sort of, I'm trying to think of the right term, right? When we use like the word sacred, it's kind of like the word improv. It gets a beating. There's a beating applied to the word sacred. People hear it and they think, oh, that means it's like beautiful or spiritual or whatever, you know, and it is beautiful and it is spiritual. But I also mean that, you know, the idea of the holy or the numinous mm-hmm. rather, is that it's almost scary yeah. too. Like there are moments of deep, you yeah. know, chasm-like yeah. moments in yeah, the music right. that to me it's like to wander through that is you know, when a piece finished, you know, I felt a little changed by it, you know, and to me that is that's powerful and that's incredible. And when I say sacred, I worry that people will think that I mean like, oh yeah, it's just really transcendently pretty and then, you know, whatever. But I mean like you feel it, you know? And to me, I don't know, it was an incredible show. And I love when you're on the roads, by the way. The roads is one of my all-time favorite sounds. Yeah. You don't use it all that often, I find, across your discography, right?
Well, it's on the Sextet album. It's on the albums with Mike Ladd. It's on the album with Wadada. I guess I don't tend to use it in the trio context because it's kind of too much information, you know. What I mean...
Do you mean like the tone of it specifically?
Well, I guess I want to be able to focus on the infinite range of what the piano can do. And I need a space to just do that, you know. And the way that piano and drums work together, the way that piano and bass work together, the vibratory experience of it, the, you know, all of that is really crucial to my understanding of music. It's sort of central, foundational.
Yeah.
The reason I play the Rhodes is because it has a lot of those same qualities, but it's in a very different, timbral space, and the range of timbre is not quite as wide, and it has a different kind of sustain quality and it has a different kind of power. So they, you know, I'd say that and the other projects I mentioned were spaces where I found ways to integrate those sounds and even at times play them both at the same time, as you saw. But I find that for the music, for the, say, the trio music, I find it more, I don't know, it gives me a little more clarity and subtlety, yeah. I'd say, with the piano.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned A Cosmic Rhythm with Each Stroke, because I do love, I love that record too. That was actually the first one of yours that I got. Great. So, you know, I do, before we wrap up, and I've really been blown away talking with you, I wanted to ask about somebody who, you know, I don't get the chance to talk about often enough on this show. I wanted to ask you about your relationship with Greg Tate, because I know that, you know, for those of us who, you know, are people who love music, but who also love music writing, you know, he's sort of this mythic figure, right? We actually taped, and this is something I've never really referenced on the podcast. I wanted to be very, very careful mm-hmm. about it, but we actually taped his final interview. I spoke with him the day He passed away the night that I spoke with him, which is mind-blowing to me. And we talked with his publicist and had the interview all cleared and made sure that everything was like okay for us to put it out. We then put it out and then immediately got a note from his family saying that they asked politely if we could remove it from the feed because they didn't feel that he sounded okay, you know, in the interview. So all of this is to say, we of course wanted to honor them above all and have no desire to, you know, put something out into the world that they were uncomfortable with. But I was extremely honored to get the chance to chat with him and felt like I learned a lot from just being with him. But I was curious if you could reflect a little on some of what you learned from Greg. When you look back, you know, what are the lessons that you carry with you moving forward? I've got my copy of Flyboy and the Buttermilk right here, where he talks about, you know, Amiri Baraka's influence on him. And obviously I know your connection with him as well. Yeah. So it's like, there's just so much, but I'm sure it's hard to boil down.
Yeah. It took me some time still working through it. None of us can really quite believe that we live in a New York without Greg Tate, a Harlem without Greg Tate, a music world without Greg Tate, a literary world without Greg Tate. I did write about him last summer, actually, about this. And in fact, I brought up some of the things you just mentioned. In particular, a lot of it is about similarities between him and Mr. Baraka, whom I also got to work with, as you said. And the way I boiled it down, I'm not sure I can remember the exact wording. But basically, I said that the way I said it was, he taught me what every musician must learn, which is how to truly hear and in doing so love another person. You know, they both of them loved me. I felt it. I still feel it. And I spent a lot of time with Mr. Tate over the years, starting before I moved to New York. I think I met him in probably in 97, but I had spent all this time with his writing for the whole entire previous decade. When I entered college in 88, I started subscribing to the Village Voice. And that's where I learned his way of, his view of the world, you know, his understanding of the interconnectedness of everybody and everything, and his vibrant way of engaging with all of it. It could have been about June Jordan or Michael Jordan or about Spike Lee or about Cecil Taylor, Michael Jackson, the Art Ensemble of Chicago, Nas, you know, I mean, he brought it all together. And he held it up and he honored it, you know, and that expression of joyful, critical, loving engagement with the world. That was, it really helped make me who I am, I'd say.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And I will say that is his, you can't write the way that he wrote or play the way that he played or think the way that he thought without loving it something, you know, without being willing to put himself on the line in such fascinating ways, right? And put others on the line too. But, you know, really just his engagement feels so encompassing. And, you know, a friend recently posted something, they posted something about Pitchfork and the current woes there, you know, and said, like, the fact that people are still talking about these, my friend Nadine Smith said this, you know, these different Pitchfork articles from 20 years ago proves the staying power. Nobody's talking about Rolling Stone or NME articles from 20 years ago. And I responded, this is true, except for Greg Tate's review of the Red Hot Chili Peppers' Californication, which ran in Rolling Stone. And I think about that like once a week. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like,
I have to go check that out.
Why? It's an incredible read. I mean it. Like, clearly, he thought about the Red Hot Chili Peppers music potentially more than the Red Hot Chili Peppers had thought about it. So, you know.
And he probably wrote so that all at the last minute, like, right, like 15 minutes before deadline.
That's the other thing. I mean, that's the other thing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He probably did. And whom among us doesn't find that all that much more miraculous? But, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. Like I said, Compassion has just been a really incredible listen. And I know that just like with Love in Exile, I'm going to be listening to it a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now. This is an incredible record. And it's really been a treat getting the chance to speak with you about it. And we left plenty undiscussed, but maybe we can do this again sometime. So thank you. Thank you so much.
It's been an honor. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. Vijay Iyer, Linda Mahon Oh, and Tyshawn Sorey's Compassion is out now on ECM Records. I'm Jason P. Woodbury. I produce, write, and host this show. Transmissions is edited by Andrew Horton, and our music comes from Frank Mastin, drawn from his discography. You can find more of his music over at mastin.bandcamp.com. Frank is the absolute best, and it's such a treat to be able to have his tunes featured in the show. Thank you, Frank. Art for this episode was created by Ian Everett, and our executive producer is Justin Gage, Aquarium Drunkard founder and head honcho. Don't miss his radio program, The Aquarium Drunkard Show, on Sirius XMU, Channel 35, 7 p.m. Pacific Time, each and every Wednesday night. Aquarium Drunkard is powered by the support of our patrons, so check out our Patreon if you want to kick in a few bucks. If you're looking for another way to support the show, why don't you just send this episode to a friend who you think might dig it? Maybe you've got a friend who's a big ECM head and they would want to hear what Vijay had to say. If so, just, shoot them a note of recommendation. You can rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you might listen. But I always feel like that direct peer-to-peer sharing, that's the way to go. That's the thing that gets me most excited these days. So send this episode to a friend if you think they might dig it. If you want to get in touch and share an idea or thoughts about the show or whatever else, you can find my contact info at Aquarium Drunkard, and you can just email me directly at jasonpwoodbury@gmail.com. Transmissions is part of the Talkhouse Podcast Network. Visit the Talkhouse for more interviews, fascinating reads, and podcasts. Next week on Transmissions, we're talking with John Lurie about Painting with John, the new Painting with John soundtrack, messing up on the set of The Last Temptation of the Christ with Scorsese, his book, The History of Bones, and a whole lot more. It's an all-timer conversation, one of my favorites that I've taped for this show, so I hope you'll come back and join us. Until then, hang in there. This transmission is concluded.